It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Gender and money are more intertwined than we think. It's not just that women make 80% of each dollar men make. It's that men think of themselves as the people who are supposed to make the money. That plays out in interesting ways in relationships, especially when a woman makes more than her husband. Aaron Reed authored a study recently that shows that when men think of themselves as breadwinners, they are more likely to denigrate their wives' careers. This holds true even if their wives or partners make more. Aaron is an associate professor of human resources and management at the DeGroote School of Business and a contributor to Harvard Business Review, which published her piece, Straying from Breadwinning, Status and Money in Men's Interpretations of Their Wives' Work Arrangements. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Carrie. I'm happy to be here.
So did the men in your study see themselves? They're split up into a few groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did they see themselves when you started talking to them?
Yeah, so they saw themselves in a couple of different ways. But what brings them all together is that they were all working for this consulting firm that demanded sort of single-minded devotion to work. Mm. Like many consulting firms, they were expected to work long hours. And the consulting firm assumed that men were ready and willing and able to work these long hours, and that if they were married, their wives probably didn't work or didn't have very important jobs, and the men could always put their jobs first. So they were all the men were dealing with that particular environment, and yet they're all in different marriages, right? And so some men sort of easily, more or less easily, saw themselves as breadwinners in the mold that the firm demanded. And what was interesting was that for many of these men, their wives were actually working, and men found different ways to explain why their wives' careers were not as important as their own. Mm. I was interviewing these men about how they cope with the work demands and how they navigate their careers. What is it like to work at this firm? And then tell me about your wife's career. And these men in this category always position themselves as the breadwinner whose job was more important. And their wives' jobs were sort of viewed as contingent, not very important, even when their wives seemed to make a lot of money. I had this other category of men in the study who were very interesting. I ended up calling them bread sharers. These men were married to women who worked outside the home. Some of the women made a lot more money than the men, so like bankers or sort of C-suite executives. But other men's wives didn't make so much money. Maybe they made about a third of family income or even less, and yet men saw their wives' work as deeply important and were willing to make changes in their own careers and in their approaches to their own work that would allow them to accommodate their wives' careers and career aspirations. And in this regard, they differed markedly from the men who identified as breadwinners.
Interesting. And did the men who wanted to accommodate their wives' careers, did their careers suffer at all for that, having that attitude?
I don't know. So what I can tell you is they left the firm at a higher rate than the breadwinners did. So they were more likely to leave. I think those were voluntary turnovers. So they would leave because their wife got a really cool job in another state. And so they would leave and take a job in the other state. Whereas the breadwinners were fairly devoted to staying at this organization and making partner. So if you think about it in terms of having a great career at this particular firm, probably the breadwinners did a little bit better. But I think the bread sharers had interesting careers as well and probably also did very well in the long term.
So what made you want to study how men see themselves when it comes to their careers and their marriages?
Yeah. So this is this project is like an outgrowth of a larger project. When I was in graduate school, I was really interested in why we still have gender inequality in the workplace. It just didn't make sense to me. And it seemed like all of the research and all the explanations focused on women. So what women were doing wrong or reasons why women didn't quite fit in, women's sort of unwillingness to, you know, work the hours that corporations and professions demand. Those were all those stories. And no one was really studying men. And I just thought, you know, men are not, the ones I know are not really so different from women. And yet they have these totally different experiences in the workplace. And so I conducted a study of men at a consulting firm, and I looked at how they relate to their work and then also how they relate to their families. Because I think we tend to assume that women's careers are very much affected by their partners' careers. And we don't think very much about the opposite relationship, how men's careers can be affected by their wives. And this research shows that they are.
And breadwinning specifically, as opposed to bread sharing, this is still a gendered concept, even though more women are likely to play the role of the breadwinner in a relationship.
Yeah. It's total. This concept is associated with men. It's pretty old school. And yet it has this tremendous staying power. Even the men who identify as bread sharers, some of them said to me, you know I work in a company where I'm expected to be the breadwinner and I'm not that. So even though they weren't living that life, it was like a really salient image that they knew they were not living up to.
I'm curious, were there more breadwinners or more bread sharers in this company?
60% were bread sharers and 40% were breadwinners in the way that they identified themselves. So close to 50%, but a high proportion were not doing what the company expected.
And were you surprised by anything that you found there?
So what going into it, I thought it would be all about how much the wife made. So I thought, you know, if a guy's married to a woman who makes a lot of money, he's totally going to identify as something that's not a breadwinner and he'll prioritize her career. But the money seemed less important. The most important thing was how important they thought their wife's work was. So if the wife was a doctor or a lawyer or worked for some nonprofit that they viewed as very important to society, men would always identify as a bread sharer because they viewed her work as very important in and of itself. And then they would explain why, if she didn't make so much money, they would explain why her earnings were so important to the family anyway. Men who did not respect their wife's work, no matter how much she made, it seemed like they would still identify as breadwinners.
So you said that this research is part of a larger body of research. What's the larger body of research, and where are you going next with this?
So the larger body of research is on men in professional careers and why we have gender inequality. And the next project related to this that I'm super excited about is about how men and women's time use is perceived and treated by their colleagues. And I'm calling it time policing. So how women's time can be policed very differently than men's. For example, if a man is not in his office, we tend to give him the benefit of the doubt and expect that, you know, he's probably with a client or doing some work elsewhere. My research is showing, and this is research with Chia Jung Sei at University of College London. Our research is finding that when women are not in the office, people almost always assume that they are home with their families.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so where are men and women? Are men at the golf course like we think they are?
Sometimes. and sometimes women are. Men and women are not so different, but we have all these biases and expectations that kind of change their experiences.
When you were at this consulting firm, presumably there were women who were also working at this consulting firm, and you were there for a long time and presumably interacted with them. What did they tell you, even though this wasn't part of your specific research?
So both men and women were frustrated by the demands the consulting firm was making, and they were frustrated at the same rate. So something like 50 to 60% of men and 50 to 60% of women were really annoyed by the amount of time that they had to put into work. But then after that, they had quite different experiences, I think.
Erin Reed is an associate professor of human resources and management at the DeGroote School of Business at McMaster University in Ontario. She's also a contributor to Harvard Business Review, and they recently published a study of hers called Straying from Breadwinning, Status and Money in Men's Interpretation of Their Wives' Work Arrangements. Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Increased fracking in Texas is affecting sand mining in western and western central Wisconsin. The sand fracking industry is expected to boom starting this year. Fracking sand is used to fill the fissures and keep the holes open in fracking mines. Where is this sand coming from exactly, and how will Wisconsin gain from the increased demand? We're taking your calls on this morning, 800-642-1234. What do you think of increased sand fracking? We're talking to Brandon Savisky first. He is a market research associate at IHS Market Energy Solutions, and he's the author of a recent report predicting a significant rise in demand for frack sand in the coming years. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So why has demand for frack sand grown so much in recent years?
Well, it's been a combination of things, but ever since the downturn, operators, those drilling and completing and fracking the wells, have been a lot more focused on capital efficiency, so essentially just trying to drill and complete the wells a lot cheaper, and there are few substitutes for fracking those wells and propping the wells themselves, and sand being one of them. They found a cheaper substitute that's essentially closer to the wells down in the Permian, which is where the majority of the fracking is currently happening, about 50 to 55% of all activity right now is in the Permian and in Eagleford.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you here for a moment. You said two things that I want to get clarification on. You talked about a downturn. When did this downturn happen?
So a downturn happened right at the end of 2015. And ever since then, operators have tried to essentially be a lot more cost efficient. And they've tried to reduce the cost, which is perfectly normal.
Right.
And then we hit a low in demand and trying to get leaner in 2016. And then we essentially started rebounding as soon as the commodity market, the oil price, started rebounding after 2016 as well.
Okay, so that leaves me with another question. Did demand perhaps go down because fracking was getting a bad image around that time, 2015, and it rebounded after the election?
No, ma'am. It was all purely related and revolving around the oil price and activity.
Okay.
So that's directly related to capital expenditures and cash flows and what the oil companies could actually spend. So they could not outspend what they were actually putting out. You can only invest as much as you're getting cash out of.
Right.
So
that makes sense. Okay. So when you talk about the Permian, talk to me about where that Permian is, what we're talking about here.
Yes. So the Permian Basin is one of the largest oil fields right now, with the most activity, and that is down in West Texas. And they have a couple sub-basins within them, which is where the majority of, about 50-55% of all oil rigs right now and frac crews are working at the moment. And that's also equates to the majority of sand demand at the moment, too.
We are talking with Brandon Savisky. He's a market research associate at IHS Market Energy Solutions. And we're talking about the increased demand for sand in northern central Wisconsin for fracking. And we're taking your calls on this. Do you live in the area where there are frack mines? What do you think of this increased demand? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So talk to me. One of the things I understand from doing the research on this is that northern white sand is better than the lower grade regional sands that are in the Permian Basin. What is the difference, and what is the difference in terms of what they can do once they're pumped into the mines?
You are correct. Northern white sand has proven for I don't know how many decades that's been around that it is the premium sand. It is a higher quality specs all around, and they grade those specs by API specs, American Petroleum Institute specs, by crush strength, by a number of things, turbidity, sericity, and the local regional sand down here in Texas has a lesser quality crush strength and whatnot. So I'm going to focus on crush strength real quick. And what that means is when it's pumped down, say 2 miles down, that's typically how far they drill and frack. When they pump that far down into the earth and into the rock, if they get to a certain level, whenever they pump and frack it and pump it into the rock and frack it into the rock, only certain spec sand can withhold certain crush strengths and certain closer stresses.
Huh.
And if it cannot, which northern white sand has proven that it can withstand almost all basins, their closer strengths. And when I say all basins, basins across the United States, they have proven it. These new sand mines in Texas, and a number of them popping up also like in Oklahoma, they haven't been proven out yet. They have other and less quality crush strengths and whatnot. So that's to be determined. Once they get crushed, or if they prove to not be of quality, then they not only close the fracture and fissures, but they produce fines, which means they actually crush that flow back out of the well and harm, produce other harmful effects.
Okay, so you were talking about, I'm taking it that the industry tried to do the lesser grade sand, which was probably cheaper in Texas. What is the cost differentiation, and how much more are they spending for Wisconsin's better sand?
You're almost looking at about 1.5 to twice as much. And the majority of that, though, and it's only, and I'm talking only in relation to getting it down to Texas at this point, because, again, that's where the big story is. That's where all the activity is. The majority of that is focused primarily in transportation and logistics. That's the biggest challenge for northern white sands and sand mines up in Wisconsin. That's the biggest challenge, because the wholesale price, the end price here in Texas for northern white sand, 60 to 65, almost sometimes 70% of that price is made up purely of transportation costs. You have the rail costs, you have the transload costs, you have the storage costs, and then after even it gets to Texas, you have what they're calling the last mile costs, which is getting it from the transload to the well site. What the local sand has as an advantage here is that a lot of the sand mines here, I'm located in Texas, I apologize for staying here. Sand mines here, a lot of them are usually located within about 75 to 100 miles within the activity of the drilling and completed. So they have the advantage of purely mining the sand
and driving it over there. Okay, I have another question before we have about a minute left here. Has the total market for northern white sand shrunk?
I would say that the market share that Northern White Sand has taken over the past year, 2 years, it has shrunk. But I do not think that it's going to be a long-term deal. There have been a number of sand companies that have also said that recently in their earnings call, just like Covia. A lot of them have tied long-term contracts to both Northern White and local regional sands. A lot of the major players in sand mines and sand companies, they are Northern White heavy asset players. So they have a motive to continue to not only operate a little bit leaner and continue to invest in the Northern White along with the local and
okay. Keep. Thank you very much. We've been talking to Brandon Savisky about frack sand mining in western and central Wisconsin. Brandon is a market research associate at IHS Market Energy Solutions. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We are going to be talking more about frack sand mining coming up. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about fracking for the rest of this hour, how Wisconsin is poised to benefit from the increased need for quality sand to help keep open the holes made by fracking drills. We just talked about the market aspects of this demand. Now we're going to talk about the community and environmental impacts. Do you live in western and west central Wisconsin? What is your reaction to the news that demand will boom with Wisconsin frack sand? Is this good for business or does it worry you? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're joined right now by Thomas Pearson. He's an associate professor of anthropology and assistant director of the Honors College at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's written a book on frack sand mining in Wisconsin, which is called When the Hills Are Gone, Frack Sand Mining and the Struggle for Community. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So we were just discussing this earlier, that frack sand mining company High Crush Partners is planning on increasing its operations by more than 45% at its mine in Monroe County. Does this news surprise you?
No. I mean, as the previous guest was explaining, there's been a resurgence of demand for frack sand, a lot of that being driven by the growth of fracking in Texas and the Permian Basin. And so it's, you know, the industry had developed quite rapidly between about 2006 to 2014, 2015 in Wisconsin. It was booming. And then it experienced a bust. The price of oil globally declined and the demand for frack sand evaporated. Hmm. And many people expected that eventually the industry would come back, that a lot of natural resource extraction industries, they are characterized by these boom and bust cycles. I think what's really interesting is that as we're kind of turning back towards increased demand for frack sand, is this new kind of factor that rather than drawing sand just from places like Wisconsin or even northern Illinois or eastern Minnesota, now drillers are finding that they can use sand from Texas, much closer to the drilling sites.
But the Texas sand, according to our last guest, isn't very good.
Yeah, and so that's kind of the interesting thing too, right? So for years when frack sand mining was really rapidly expanding in western Wisconsin, everyone was talking about the high quality of what's called northern white sand. And it's, you know, not only does western Wisconsin have significant deposits of silica sandstone, but it's It's especially hard, and with some processing, the grains are very, very round and consistent in their roundness, and so they can produce a type of propant or frac sand that is desirable, and they can produce it in pretty large quantities. And everyone said that the sand that was available elsewhere was much lower quality because they it would be more angular, or they couldn't get the consistent grain size and so on. But in the last year or so, drillers have been experimenting with these other types of sand because they don't have to pay the transportation costs and the logistics costs as the previous guest was describing. And they are using much larger quantities now than they were 3, 4, 5 years ago.
And why?
I don't fully understand the kind of engineering aspect of it, but I guess they're finding that they can produce the amount of oil or natural gas by pumping much larger quantities of sand into these horizontal wells that they're fracking. So whereas just 4 or 5 years ago, they were using a couple thousand tons of sand per frack job. There are reports this year that some well sites are using up to 8, 9, 10,000 tons of sand.
Wow. We are talking about frack sand mining, which is happening in western Wisconsin. What do you think of the increase in frack sand mining and the increased revenue that it will likely bring to the state? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I want to talk about how long frack sand mines have been in Wisconsin and what their history is. I mean, you said a few minutes ago, 2006 to like 2015, the business was booming. But when did we start, and what has been the impact?
Yeah, I mean, sand mining has existed in Wisconsin for decades. And prior to about 2006, there were some industrial sand mining operations in Wisconsin, and a few that had been around for quite a while. But there were a handful. There were 4 or 5 industrial sand mining operations. And it's around 2006 that we began to see a rapid growth of industrial sand mining in western Wisconsin. And it's not just, industrial sand mining is a relatively larger scale than, sand that might be quarried for use in local construction and so on. And the increased growth began to occur around 2006, but really took off in around 2009, 2010. And so by 2011, the DNR was, they were counting around 41 active or permitted operations in western Wisconsin. And this can include the site of extraction or processing plants that may or may not be at that actual mine site, and then also the transload or the rail spurs operations that are used to load the sand onto trains and then to ship it out of western Wisconsin. And then by 2012, they were counting roughly 107 sites, and then in 2015, right when the industry began to slow down, the DNR was counting roughly 128 total facilities. Huh. So in a relatively short period of time, just 6 or 7 years, we went from roffly 5, 6 operations to over 100. And many of these concentrated in western Wisconsin, but clustered in a few key areas within western Wisconsin, not only where sand is located, but also in close proximity to transportation infrastructure, rail lines in particular. And this was, this rapid growth was tremendously controversial in many communities in western Wisconsin. It caught a lot of places off guard. Many of the communities were communities that didn't have a history of mining or extractive industries. And you know, while the growth of any mining or extractive industry generates potential economic benefits and wealth for some, there are also costs involved. There are unintended consequences that others then have to shoulder. And so it was incredibly divisive and controversial in many places.
Okay, so I want to get to the unintended consequences in a moment, but 100 went from a few, like five or six, to 128 mining companies. How many jobs did this create?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of different attempts to estimate the jobs created. I mean, some economists or some analysts will count the actual direct employment at mining operations, and others will try to calculate the indirect or the spin-off jobs. I think that the estimates when the industry was peaking kind of ranged between roughly 3,000 to a potential of 5,000 jobs, including indirect in western Wisconsin. Whether or not we ever reached that, I'm not sure. And then, you know, in addition to creating jobs, there are other factors that have to be taken into consideration. You know, when you're talking about economic benefits, you have to consider whether a community is in a position to capture those economic benefits. The people employed by a mining operation, do they live in the community hosting the mine, or are they commuting from the next county over? Or next state over, exactly. So
right.
will those salaries, will those economic benefits remain in the host community, or will they leak out of it? And then, you know, as we've seen, the story of frac sand mining in Wisconsin is a story of a very volatile and cyclical industry. So several years ago, the industry was promising economic benefits and job creation. And, you know, this was viewed as something that, you know, especially in the context of the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, many communities felt that they had to accommodate this new industry, that it was inevitable. But then,
so we are taking calls on this, and actually we have a call on this very topic. Andrew from Ladysmith, welcome to the program.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, so what's your comment?
I just had a couple questions basically relating to what's going to happen after the sand mines are used up. I used to work for one that was near our area, and I do believe that was designed to be a 25-year mine. And after that, are they supposed to turn the land back over to the state, or is that going to be up for private sale? I guess, how is the DNR going to handle that?
Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew. Thomas, mines are cyclical. And if this goes away, will they turn it back over to the state? Will the jobs and economic benefits we've been talking about go away? You have about 30 seconds, and then we'll have to take a break.
Yeah, in terms of the kind of what specifically happens to a mine, so there's a state law that requires mining operations to have a so-called reclamation plan, so a plan for how they'll restore the land to an acceptable land use, and that's administered at the county level, and so it varies from county to county and then from specific operation to specific operation.
Okay, so we're going to go into that when we come back. We're talking to Thomas Pearson, who is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin Stout. He's an expert on frac sand mining, which is gaining in Wisconsin. Taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Frac sand mining is poised for growth in western Wisconsin as demand for oil and natural gas fracking has increased in Texas. Frac sand keeps open the holes made by the frac drills. What has frac sand mining in your community meant for business in your area? Has it been a boon, or has it put pressure on services and infrastructure? What about the environment? Has it caused any problems for the relationships in your community? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking to Thomas Pearson. He is with the University of Wisconsin Stout, and he is an expert on frac sand mining. Thomas, before the break, we hit on a number of things that I want to follow back on here. One is the unintended consequences. You were talking about a new business comes into the area, jobs are created, but we don't necessarily know who those jobs go to. So it may be that people come to the area, then they need housing, then there's increased demand on infrastructure. How have the towns that have hosted new frac sand mines, how have they fared in terms of this?
I think that it varies a lot across the counties where frac sand mining occurs. I think it's important to recognize that a frac sand mine, it's a relatively smaller scale than other types of mining or other types of metallic mining, which tend to be much bigger, or even, fracking itself in places like the Permian Basin in Texas or in the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. When they experience these resource booms, it's at a much larger scale in terms of employment, in terms of people moving to the area to work on drilling rigs and so on. Frac sand mining, because it's a smaller scale, because of one individual mine might employ between a dozen to 50, 60 people if you're counting truck drivers and whatnot, it's not, it doesn't have the same kind of boomtown dynamics that other parts of the country might experience with fracking. In terms of the, I don't think the economic impact is as acutely felt in many communities as, say, in Texas or in North Dakota.
I want to move from the economic impact to the environmental impact, and we have a question about that. Lori from Vernon County, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm really glad you finally got to the environmental impact. All you've been talking about is the benefits, and as your expert just said, there's not a whole lot of job benefits, but it is a huge impact on the neighbors. And they may be small in employment, but these are hundreds of acres of mine, and there's huge acres of mine. So maybe your expert could tell us what the acreage is. He could also talk about the water. They need to wash the sand with our groundwater. So that's part of the unregulated high capacity wells are taking our water. The sand that they're using is our aquifer here. It holds our water here. So they're taking it out and they're shipping it there. They're using our water to wash it. And then the reclamation, this is untested. So there's like one study, on planting a few prairie grasses on it, but there's no plan for reclamation. There's no requirement for reclamation. And another economic impact you might talk about is how it's affecting the neighbors. They've got these facilities are going 24 hours a day. There are trucks moving 24 hours a day. It's crashing land values of the neighbors who have no say in this. So please give us a few minutes of
You got it. We're going to talk about this for the rest of the show that we have left. Thomas, you want to address her concerns here?
Yeah, I mean, Lori is absolutely correct that this has been an issue that is very controversial because of the various impacts on neighbors and on places that host mines. As I mentioned earlier, it, while there might be some who benefit economically, there are others that shoulder the costs, which might include new environmental concerns, not only related to groundwater, but related to things like silica dust, and that's an issue that many concerned citizens have raised. The extraction and processing of frac sand, it generates very fine particles of silica dust, it's hazardous when inhaled. If you're exposed over the course of many years, you can develop lung problems, silicosis, and it's not, there's a lot of understanding of trying to manage the risks and exposure to workers within workplace settings. But a lot of people have raised questions about whether or not residents who live near mining operations are being exposed at unsafe levels. And some people feel that it's a non-issue. Others say that more research needs to be done. And so this is something that many residents have been concerned about, and it, you know, it's an environmental health impact. And then, in addition to just the new environmental health concerns, as Lori was describing, you're introducing an industrial mining operation often into a previously picturesque rural community,
mm-hmm.
and people are, you know, that not only is the landscape being completely altered, but you're changing places that rural landscapes and farming landscapes that people had identified with that were meaningful to them, and so there's a disruption to how they connect to those places and how that ties into their sense of community and their sense of self. There, you know, when you live near an industrial operation, there's noise, there's truck traffic, it's dirty. There are things that affect your quality of life, and so it can be very stressful. There's, you know, increased stress and anxiety, uncertainties related to potential environmental health impacts, and not knowing whether or not you are at risk that further exacerbates that stress. So for all of these reasons, the, you know, in places that have hosted frac sand mines, it has been extremely controversial.
You know, it strikes me that we haven't learned the lessons of the 70s. I've covered Superfund sites that were mined with chemicals that then became toxic in the 70s and actually even earlier. And are we doing the same kind of thing? Are we setting ourselves up, first of all, to cost more money once lawsuits start coming in and the sites need to be cleaned up, but also hurting the very people that we are purporting to be helping?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that in our industrial society, our society right now is organized around a dependency on fossil fuels, and the extraction and production of those fuels is a very messy business, whether we're talking about the sites of fracking or oil and gas drilling itself, whether we're talking about frac sand mining, the pipelines that are used to transport these materials, the refineries in places like Minneapolis and Chicago and Superior and elsewhere. You know, there's this large system, this commodity chain and system that we rely on. But, you know, while our way of life is dependent on it, it comes at great cost. It might not be immediate, but there are tremendous environmental impacts, whether it's people who live on the fence line being exposed to pollution and contamination, or our kind of denial of, not denial, but our reluctance to really confront the challenges of climate change.
Mm.
So yeah, this is a dynamic that has been a part of industrial society for decades, and we're still contending with it.
We are going to follow this up. This is a really important issue. Thomas Pearson is an associate professor of anthropology and assistant director of the Honors College at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's written a book on frac sand mining in Wisconsin. Thomas, thank you for being with us today. This has been really illuminating for me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.